Good morning, everyone. So as Don says, here we all are, same as ever. We are reading in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 6. And we've read the first section last week. So we're going to start now at the break on page 538. Savitri was in such a state of bliss after the finding of her soul. And it seemed as if that bliss was emanating from her all around to the ascetics of the wood and even the creatures and the weather. Everything was just perfect. And even when she used what the poet calls her newborn foreseeing sight, when she looked into the future, she saw Satyavan fulfilling a rich and varied life, a complete life, a sovereign, the cyclic rondure of a sovereign life. But then, suddenly, one night, when she was there in the little hut along with him, it's as if a great cloud of darkness came rolling over the edge of the globe and swallowed everything up. And she was attacked, one can say, by this voice of darkness, which told her, well, who are you? What are you? You are nothing. I am everything. I am death and I devour everything. And that voice, the power of that voice, the poet tells us, left Savitri's inner world laid waste, as if there'd been a huge sandstorm coming and swallowing up everything, devastating her inner life. But then, in response to that voice of darkness, another voice came, a voice from above, which told her to be careful, not to expose her newborn happiness, to keep it quietly within her, and to practice within herself a kind of widening. She was told that in order for her to fulfill her mission, she needs to do this inner widening so that the whole universe is just like a tiny corner of her consciousness. And she was advised to consent to be nothing and none. This is the top of page 538. Consent to be nothing and none. Dissolve time's work. Cast off thy mind. Step back from form and name. Annul thyself that only God may be. You have to become nothing. So in the next sections of the canto, we will see her practicing what she's guided to do. So we'll start reading here in the middle. Joel, you will start. Page 538, at the break.
Thus spoke the mighty and uplifting voice, and Savitri heard. She bowed her head and mused, plunging her deep regard into herself, in her soul's privacy, in the silent night. Aloof and standing back, detached and calm, a witness of the drama of herself, a student of her own interior scene, she watched the passion and the toil of life, and heard in the crowded thoroughfares of mind the unceasing tread and passage of her thoughts. All she allowed to rise that chose to stir, calling, compelling not, forbidding not, she left all to the process formed in time and the free initiative of nature's will. Thus, following the complex human play, she heard the prompter's voice behind the scenes, perceived the original libretto's set and the organ team of the composer force. Or she beheld that surges from man's depths, the animal instincts crawling mid life's trees, the impulses that whisper to the heart, and passions, tender chase, sweeping the nose. She saw the powers that stare from the abyss and the wordless light that liberates the soul.
Thank you. So the first thing that Savitri does is to look within herself, plunging her deep regard into herself, into the depths of her being, in her soul's privacy, in the silent night. And she steps back from everything that she perceives, aloof, standing back, detached and calm, a witness of the drama of herself, a student of her own interior scene. She watched the passion and the toil of life, and heard in the crowded thoroughfares of mind the unceasing tread and passage of her thoughts. So this is a practice and a discipline that's been recommended to seekers from time immemorial, that to detach oneself from the outer life, one has to find this way of going deep within and silently observing. There was a time when the mother was studying the Dhammapada, the Buddhist scriptures, with the students of the ashram school in her evening classes. And this was one of the first things that she took up. And we shall see in the coming sections how Savitri step by step observes this discipline. So it's really a kind of guide for all of us who want to do deep inner introspection. We can follow these sentences and see step by step what are the recommendations. So first there's this stepping back, observing. And she allows everything that comes in. She doesn't react to anything. She just stays detached with that, from that. All she allowed to rise, that chose to stir, whatever wanted to move within her being, she did that. She just allowed it to happen. She didn't call anything. She didn't force anything. She didn't forbid anything. She just left everything to the process formed in time and the free initiative of nature's will. Yes? Sorry?
No. Repeat the question, please.
The question was, what is the meaning of naught? Yeah. Naught is a nice poetic way of saying nothing. So she didn't call anything, and she didn't force anything, she didn't forbid anything. She just, whatever happens in the nature, she allows it to happen and observes quietly. She leaves it all to the process formed in time, whatever formations have been made, and the free initiative of nature's will, just whatever wants to happen in the human nature.
Point three, initiative of nature's will, it's a little bit touching because there are different understanding of nature. And when I listened again to your talk on this Russian closet, you pointed very much out you have to the highest and to the deepest of nature's will to find out. So I think that is something which is not so in our consciousness. And you can look at it as we more about this free initiative of nature's will.
I don't want to say any more about it just now. We will watch what happens, what Savitri experiences in the next section. And the point is simply this non-interference, standing back, observing, not interfering. That's the first step, it seems, in this discipline. And when she does this, when she maintains this stepping back, she's able to follow what the poet calls the complex human play to see the way that things are happening in human consciousness. She heard the prompter's voice behind the scenes, as if there's a drama going on. We are all participating in a drama, and this drama has a plot. And if we listen, we can hear the prompter. In a theatre where plays are played, somebody sits underneath the stage, and if the actors lose track and forget what they're supposed to be doing or saying, then this souffleur, he whispers to them and tells them what to do. That's the prompter. So there's a prompter prompting us also, you know, our parts in the play. Sometimes he gives good prompting and sometimes maybe not so good. But anyway, there he is. So she hears that voice of the prompter hiding behind the scenes, and she becomes aware of the original libretto's set. The libretto is usually, I think, in an opera. It is the songs that have been set, which have to be sung in the course of the drama. So that's quite an important element in musical performances. So in the performance of life, there's also something that we're supposed to follow and do in the drama. She becomes aware of that libretto, of what is supposed to happen, and she becomes aware of the organ theme of the composer force. So this libretto, this drama, this opera, or whatever it is, has been composed. There's a power behind which has decided how things should be. And she becomes aware of that. And she beheld, she saw, she became aware of everything that surges up from man's depths, from the lower levels of our human nature. She becomes aware of the animal instincts which are still operative in our human nature, which have come from far back in early stages of our evolution. There's a part of the poem where these animal instincts, very, very interestingly, Sri Aurobindo shows us how they have developed and where they've come from. She becomes aware of the impulses that whisper to the heart. And when they whisper to the heart, then sometimes they arouse very violent emotions. The passion's thunder chase, sweeping through the nerves, almost irresistible, these impulses. She saw the powers that stare from the abyss, from the lower depths. They are looking up at us, affecting us. And at the same time, she becomes aware of the other end of the spectrum, the wordless light that liberates the soul. So this is the first step. Suresh, you're going to read? No? I'm sorry, dear, I don't know your name. You're not going to read either. Margaret. It's the last line on page 538. Franz?
But most her gaze pursued the birds of soul. Enfranchised from the look of surface mind, she posed not to survey the official case, the issue of forms from the office of the brain, its factory of thought sounds and soundless words, and voices stored within unheard by men. Its mint and treasury of shining coin. These were but counters in my simple game. A gramophone disc, a reproductions film, a list of signs, a cipher, and a code. In our unseen, subtle body, song is born. For there it enters from the cosmic field. Oft from the soul stepped out a naked thought, luminous, with mysterious lips and wonderful eyes, or from her heart emerged some burning face. and look for life and love and passionate truth. Aspire to heaven or embrace the world, or let the fancy light the fleeting moon across the dull sky of man's common days, amidst the doubtful certitudes of earth's lore, to the celestial beauty of faith give form, as if at a flower prints in a dingy room, loved in a golden vase, one living rose.
Thank you. So this is now the second step, that in this process of observation, she's trying to find the birth of thought. Where do our thoughts come from? But she's already been affranchised, set free from the look of surface mind. So she doesn't just waste time surveying the official case, the surface appearances, the way that forms are issued from the office of the brain, a factory of thought sounds and soundless words and voices stored within by men, its mint and treasury of shining coin, the everyday currency of daily thought. She's affranchised and she doesn't need to look at that stuff. She's already gone through such a long introspection in Book 7, Canto 2. Very, very interesting part of the poem, which is often overlooked, I think, after she's been told to look within herself and find her soul. And there's that injunction to her, remember why thou camest. But then after that passage, which we remember very well, there comes a long passage about how thought has developed in humanity in the course of its evolution and what all it involves, this inner life. It's a very, very interesting part of the poem, but often overlooked, I find. But she's gone past through all that. She knows already what she has to do to push all that aside in order to find her soul.
So Lord, these words are thought sound and soundless words.
Wonderful poetry. Oh yes, this is what the brain does. It's factory of thought sounds and soundless words. I suppose if we observe ourselves, we can hear these things, you know, the thought sounds and the soundless words. Words in your head which don't actually have any sound. They're not uttered. They're not spoken out. But there they are, the words in your head. This is a kind of factory. We even pick up these thought sounds and soundless words from other people, from our environment, from our... If we really start looking, there's quite a thick atmosphere of thought, sound and soundless words that we are moving around in all the time and picking up influences and suggestions from it. So she's already aware of that and that this is not what she has to concentrate on now. So she sets that aside. It's a very important process for us. And again, we will see this a little later on, that these words, if we're just picking them up from the atmosphere and the thoughts, you know, that are circling in our environment, that's not very helpful. So Mother says, I think, in this commentaries on the Dhammapada, which I mentioned before, it's very helpful to read these texts together. If it is possible to silence the mind enough, as Savitri is attempting to do here, then real thoughts from the world of higher mind can come either as a sound, as a word, or as something soundless. And she says one should be very quiet and patient then to let that thought clothe itself in words. And then those words have some power, either inwardly or when outwardly expressed. So there's the factory of the brain, which just manufactures everyday thoughts. These were, he says, but counters, only little substitutes, counters in mind's symbol game. Or it's something like nowadays, can one speak about gramophones and discs? Well, of course, we still have our discs, no?
Mobile phones as well.
These things that repeat themselves all the time, or a reproductions film, repetitive things, a list of signs, a cipher. A cipher is a secret code, perhaps, or a nothing and a code. And then he says, in our unseen, subtle body, thought is born, or there it enters from the cosmic field. Either it comes up from within our own body, or it comes to us from the universe. But in Savitri's case, what happens is that from her soul, a naked thought, one that hasn't been dressed up in words yet, luminous, with mysteried lips and wonderful eyes, this emerged. She saw something beautiful coming from the soul like that. Or from her heart emerged some burning face full of, flame, the flame of aspiration, and looked for life and love and passionate truth, aspired to heaven or embraced the world, or led the fancy like a fleeting moon, something that's quite misleading, nor the... the moon that's covered with shadows, with clouds, led the fancy like a fleeting moon across the dull sky of man's common days amidst the doubtful certitudes of earth's law. This word law comes quite often in the poem. It means what has been learned. So what we feel is knowledge that has been handed down to us. It's something that's been had a long life already in mind. Or that burning face, the coming from the heart, not only leads the fancy like a fleeting moon, giving wonderful dreams, it gives form to the celestial beauty, the heavenly beauty of faith. And the poet gives such a beautiful image for this. He says, it's as if at flower prints in a dingy room laughed in a golden vase one living rose. I don't know if you can imagine going up into a dusty attic, and there's all kinds of things that have been collected over the years, not very significant, but there, in that dingy room, there's a golden vase and one living rose. And that represents the beauty of faith. Sudanya, will you read? You've got a difficult word right at the beginning of the sentence. Then. A thaumaturge.
Angels stood behind the bend,
in flashing armor, holding hands of air, and all heaven's rays into the earthly forms. Imaginations came up from our breast, unearthly beauty, crosses of surprising joy, and plans of miracle, dreams of delight, around her never put us clustering goals. Her large sensations of the thrilling worlds stream their dumb movements of the unformed idea, invading the small sensitive soul of the world. They brought their mute and utter resonance to kindle the figures of the heavenly peace below. Creatures formed their wordless wish and longings of physical sweetness and ecstasy, translated into the essence of cry that claps on objects and that claps on souls. Her body's thoughts climbed from her conscious knees and cried,
carried
their yearning to its mystic crown. Her nature's murmurs made the ineffable.
Thank you. So this is a lovely description of the functioning of the different chakras.
Functioning of the different
chakras, the subtle centers in the subtle body. He starts with the heart, I think. Or there was this thaumaturge. Where is he? That's after the flower prince. This thaumaturge, a miracle worker, is sitting in the depths of her heart. And that thaumaturge, that magician, compels in her being the forward stride, the urge to move forward, the upward look, until the wonderful power of wonder, of astonishment, leaped into the illumined breast, fills that area around the heart, so that life grew marvelous with transfiguring hope. That's a movement coming from the heart center. And then a seeing will. This is the center here in the brow. A seeing will. It has a power of vision. This ponders. There's some thought happening there between the brows. And those thoughts are like angels, shining angels. They're standing behind the brain, and the poet pictures them as armed knights in flashing armor, folding hands of prayer, and they are pouring down heaven's rays into the earthly form, into the body. Also from the breast area, the heart area, imaginations are flaming up in unearthly beauty, touches of surpassing joy, and plans of miracle, dreams of delight. And then around the navel lotus, clustering close, sensations, her large sensations of the teeming worlds. She becomes aware of what is going on in the subtle worlds. There streamed all these sensations, streamed their dumb movements of the unformed idea. Then the next chakra is the small sensitive flower of the throat, where speech and creativity come from. They brought their mute, unuttered resonances. It's as if there is some vibration going on there to kindle the figures of a heavenly speech. That's the function of the throat center. And below, lower down, desires formed, their wordless wish and their longings of physical sweetness and ecstasy. And they almost as if they cry out, translated into the accents of a cry, their grasp on objects and their clasp on souls. So in this way, her body's thoughts climbed from her conscious limbs and carried their yearnings to the mystic crown, this center here above the crown of the head, where nature's murmurs, all those longings and wishes of the being meet the ineffable, what cannot be expressed. Somewhere in the series of Huta's paintings, she shows this different, where the centers and the beings that are expressing themselves through them. Tinaka, would you read next?
But for the mortal,
yes.
But for the mortal prisoned in an outward mind, all must present their passports at its door. Disguised, they must don the official cap and mask, or pass as manufacturers of the brain. Unknown their secret truth and hidden sword. Only to the inner mind they speak direct, put on a body and a suit of words. Their passage seen, their message heard and known, their birthplace and their natal mark revealed, and stand confessed to an immortal sight, are nature's messengers to the witness soul. Impenetrable, withheld from mortal sense, the inner chambers of the spirit's house disclose to her their happenings and their guests. Eyes look through crevices in the invisible wall, and through the secrecy of unseen doors, there came into mind's life frontal room thoughts that enlarged our limited human range, lifted the ideal's half-quenched or sinking torch, or peered through the finite at the infinite. A sight opened upon the invisible, and sensed the shapes that mortal eyes see not, the sounds that mortal listening cannot hear, the blissful sweetness of the intangible's touch, the objects that to us are empty air, are there the stuff of daily experience and the common pendulum of sense and thought.
Thank you. These things are going on in us if we're sensitive enough to become aware of them. Normally we are not. We are the mortals prisoned in outward mind. So in our case, all these wonderful subtle movements somehow have to put on disguise to enter our consciousness. They might have to present their passports, identify themselves, but it's a false identity. They have to disguise themselves, put on the official cap and mask. They have to present themselves as if they're something that's been manufactured in our own brain. So in this way, the secret truth and hidden source of these marvelous experiences are unrecognized. They can only speak to the inner mind. For the inner mind, they can put on a body, a subtle form, and assume a subtle voice. Then the way they've come, their passage will be seen, and their message can be heard and known, and even their source, their birthplace, and their natal mark reveal what's their unique characteristic. Then they stand confessed, they reveal themselves to the immortal's sight. These are our nature's messengers to the witness soul. So if we are living in our witness soul, we will have all these experiences and understandings. But they are impenetrable, withheld from our senses, our mortal sense. The inner chambers of the spirit's house, the inner room of the spirit, reveal to Savitri their happenings and their guests. It's as if eyes are looking through crevices in an invisible wall, and through the secrecy of unseen doors, there came into mind's little frontal room here thoughts that enlarged our limited human range. These thoughts lift the ideal's torch, even if it's half quenched, half put out, or sinking, they lift it up, or they peer through the finite, all the limited forms that we are aware of here, to the infinite. So for Savitri, a sight opened upon the invisible, as it has happened with King Aswapati much earlier in the poem. That sense, that sight sensed the shapes that our mortal eyes do not see, and the sounds that our mortal listening cannot hear. She could experience the blissful sweetness of the intangible's touch, the touch of what can't be touched, the objects, subtle objects, that to us are just empty air, but there they're the stuff of daily experience and the common pabulum of sense and thought. Pabulum is baby food, very easily digestible. Tuan, will you read?
The beings of the subtle realms appear, and scenes concealed behind our earthly sea. She saw the life of remote continents, and distance deafened not to voices far. She felt the movements crossing unknown minds. The past events occurred before her eyes. The great world's thoughts were part of her own thought. The feelings done forever and unshared. The ideas that never found an utterance. The then subconscious incoherent hints laid bare, a meaning twisted, deep and strange. The bizarre secret of their fumbling speech, their links with underlying reality. The unseen grew visible and audible. Thoughts leaped down from a superconscious field, like eagles swooping from a viewless. Thoughts gleamed up from the screened subliminal depths, like golden fishes from a hidden sea. This world is a vast, unbroken totality. A deep solidarity joins its contrary power. God's summits look back on the mute abyss. So, man evolving to the finest heights, colored still with the animal and the djinn. The human godhead with stargazer eyes lives still in one house with the primal beast. The high meets the low, all is a single. So she beheld the many birds of thought, if birds can be of what eternal is. For the eternal's powers are like himself, timeless in the timeless, in time ever born.
So beautiful. Anything to ask? Kolux means holds a conversation with the animal and the djinn. These are these subtle spirits. They belong in Islamic mythology, and they are supposed to be very, very close to us. They are spirit beings who are very close to human beings. They are always watching us and interested in what we are doing. And of course, in the fairy stories, you may be able to shut one in a bottle, and then it has to do what you want. It has to obey your commands. So in this way, she set out to find out the births of thought, and now she's seeing these many births of thought. And it's interesting, he says, if births can be of what is eternal. But he says, yes, it can be, because the eternal's powers are just like himself, timeless in the timeless, in time ever born, eternally reborn. Then she sees another aspect. Lyupa, you'll read line 349 here.
This bush is so that all in outer mind is me, not born, a product perishable, forget.
Forged
in the body's factory by God's force. This mind is a dynamic small machine, producing ceaselessly, till it bears out. With raw material drawn from the outside world, the patterns sketched out by an artist god. Often our thoughts are finished cosmic wheels, admitted by a silent office gate and passed through the subconscious galleries, then issued in times marked as private milk. for now they bear the living person's stamp, a trick special to cleanse them his wound. All else in nature's craft and this two herbs. Our task are given, we are but instrument. Nothing is all our own that we create. The power that acts in us is not our force. The genius too receives from some higher form, concealed in the suburban secrecy. The work that gives him a modern name, the word, the form, the charm, the glory, and grace. Our mission sparks from a stupendous fire, a sample from the laboratory of God, of which he holds the
patent
upon earth, comes to him wrapped in golden covering. He listens for inspiration's postman knock and takes delivery of the priceless gift, a little spoiled by a receiver mind, or mixed with the manufacture of his brain. When least defaced, then it is most divine.
Thank you. She saw that everything in our outer mind is made. It's not born. It's a perishable product, which means has been forged in the body's factory by earth force. We can have the double understanding of this word forged here. A forgery is something that's not genuine or something false, but it's also something that's been manufactured, made. So everything in our outer mind is made, not born, and it's a perishable product that's been made in the body's factory by earth force, not heaven force. This mind is a dynamic small machine producing ceaselessly till it wears out. It's producing with raw material drawn from the outside world, but it's following patterns that have been sketched out by an artist God. Often our thoughts are finished cosmic wares. They've been made in the universe, and then they've been secretly allowed into a through a silent office gate and passed through the subconscious galleries, all these underground passages, and then they're presented in the market and of time as private make, because now they can be passed off as private make, because now they live, they carry some kind of mark of a living person. They've passed through his consciousness, and so they bear that living person's stamp. Some trick or some special color indicates that they've passed through his consciousness, and that he claims them as his own. Everything else is done by nature, and even this too she has done. Our tasks are given to us. We're just instruments, tools. Nothing is all our own that we create. The power that acts in us is not our force. And this is true, he says, this is true even for those great beings that we consider to be geniuses. The genius too, he's receiving from some high fount, some source that's hidden in a supernal secrecy on some very high level. He receives that work that gives him an immortal name. The word, the form, the charm, the glory and grace are missioned sparks from a stupendous fire that have been sent to him. They're a sample from the laboratory of God, of which he holds the patent upon earth. So we can think of Sri Aurobindo having the patent for this superb poetry, and it's missioned to him.
So
yes. It comes to him wrapped in golden coverings. And he listens. There's a special knock, inspiration's postman knock, that tells him that something has arrived. And he takes delivery of that priceless gift, a little spoilt, by the receiver mind, or mixed with the manufacture of his brain. This happens too, no? When least defaced, then is it most divine. Patty, you like to read?
Although his ego claims the world for its use, man is a dynamo for the cosmic work. Nature does most in him, God the high rest. Only his soul's acceptance is his own. This independent, once a power supreme, self-born before the universe was made, accepting the cosmos, finds himself nature's serf when he becomes her freedman. Appearance in our mortal front, our greater truth of being lies behind. Our consciousness is cosmic and immense, but only when we break through matter's wall, in that spiritual vastness, can we stand where we can live the masters of our world. Mind is only a means, and body a tomb. For above the birth of body and of thought, our spirit's truth lives in the naked self, and from that height, unbound, surveys the world. Out of the mind, she rose to escape its law, that it might sleep in some deep shadow of itself, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. High she attained, and stood from nature free, and saw creation's light from far above. Thence upon all, she laid her sovereign will, to dedicate it to God's timeless calm. Then all grew tranquil in her being's space. Only sometimes, small thoughts arose and fed, like quiet waves upon a silent sea, or ripples passing over a lonely pool, when a stray stone disturbs its dreaming rest. Yet the mind's factory had ceased to work. There was no sound of the dynamo's throb. There came no call from the still fields of life. Then even those stirrings rose in her no more. Her mind now seemed like a vast empty room, or like a peaceful landscape without sound. This men call quietly and prize as peace, but to her deeper sight, all yet was there, effervescing like a chaos under a lid. Feelings and thoughts cried out for word and act, but found no response in the silenced brain. All was suppressed, at every moment might explode in thought. Then this too falls, the body seemed a stone. All now was a wide, mighty vacancy, but still excluded from eternity's hush, for still was far the repose of the absolute and the ocean silence of infinity.
Yes, let's pause there. Thank you. Isn't it a wonderful picture? It's actually the painting we will see, I think, no? This, her mind becomes like a vast empty room. So the thoughts that come now on page 544, even now some thoughts could cross her solitude. These surged not from the depths or from within, cast up from formlessness to seek a form. They didn't speak to the body's need, nor the call of mind. These seemed not born nor made in human time. They're a different kind of thought. They are children of cosmic nature from a far world. And these thoughts come in a complete armor of words. This is what Mother says we should wait for if we're calling for inspiration, that when the thoughts come already with their own armor or covering of words, they posted, they're traveling like travelers in an alien space, a strange space, out of some far expanse. They seem to come as if carried on vast wings like large white sails, and with easy access reached the inner ear, as if they used a natural privileged right to the high royal entries of the soul. So these thoughts are coming from another world altogether. She can't see the path by which they have come. As yet, Their path lay deep, concealed in light. Then, looking to know whence, from where these intruders come, these thoughts, she saw a spiritual immensity pervading and encompassing the world space as ether, our transparent, tangible air. This a spiritual immensity is pervading, it's flowing through our atmosphere and surrounding it, encompassing the world space. And the poet says that ether has this relationship to our transparent, tangible air. In tradition, there are these different elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether. And the scientists are sure that they've disproved ether. It doesn't exist. But Sri Aurobindo repeatedly tells us that it does exist.
So, ether is a medium.
Sorry?
Ether is a medium.
It's an element, no? Yes, I suppose like air is a medium. It's actually more subtle, more refined than air. It's the most refined element of the five. It's in Sanskrit, I think it's what we call Akash, beyond the sky.
You would think it'd be easier for them to get one, the idea they go into outer space where, beyond where air is. So what are they in?
They're in ether. So there, through that spiritual immensity, Savitri sees sailing tranquilly a thought, like a ship, as smoothly glides a ship nearing its port, ignorant of embargo and blockade. That ship hasn't been informed or warned that there's a cholera epidemic coming, going on, or a COVID epidemic, and they're not allowed to enter. They won't be allowed to enter. That thought is quite confident of entrance, and the visa seal. I've got my visa. Nothing will stop me. And it came to the silent city of the brain, towards its accustomed and expectant key, the place where it always ties up. Lands. And that's where it always goes, and even the key is waiting, expecting it to come. But instead, there comes this barring will, a blow of force, as if it's been shot by a cannon, sank, vanishing in that spiritual immensity, in that ocean. After a long, vacant pause, another appeared, and others, one by one, suddenly emerged. Minds, unexpected visitors from the unseen, like far-off sails upon a lonely sea. Eugen. Page 544, almost at the bottom. Last three lines. So 540.
545 at the top.
No, we stopped at like far-off sails upon a lonely sea. That's page 544. There's four lines.
We stopped at...
Silent spirit? No. Yeah?
We stopped at 5... we stopped at 426.
Sails upon a lonely sea. That's the last line that I read. Yes. That's at the bottom of page 544. We start with the next line. But soon that commerce failed. Yes.
But soon that commerce failed, none reached mind's coast. Then all grew still, nothing moved anymore. Immobile, self-wrapped, timeless, solitary. A silent spirit pervaded silent space. In that absolute stillness, bare and formidable, there was glimpsed an all-negating void supreme that claimed its mystic nihil's sovereign mind. To cancel nature and deny the soul. Even the nude sense of self grew pale and thin. Impersonal, signless, featureless, void of forms, a blank pure consciousness had replaced the mind. Her spirit seemed the substance of a name, the world a picture, symbol drawn on self, a dream of images, a dream of sounds, built up the semblance of a universe, or lent to spirit the appearance of a world. This was self-seeing in that intolerant hush. No notion and no concept could take shape. There was no sense to frame the figure of things. A sheer self-sight was there. No thought arose. Emotion slept deep down in the still heart, or lay buried in a cemetery of peace. All feelings seemed quiescent, calm or dead, as if the heartstrings rent could work no more. And joy and grief could never rise again. The heart beat on with an unconscious rhythm, but no response came from it and no cry. Vain was the provocation of events. Nothing within answered an outside touch. No nerve was stirred and no reaction arose. Yet still her body saw and moved and spoke. It understood without the aid of thought. It said whatever needed to be said. It did whatever needed to be done. There was no person there behind the act. No mind that chose or passed the fitting word. All wrought like an unbearing act machine, as if continuing old habitual currents and pushed by an old unexhausted force. The engine did the work for which it was made. Her consciousness looked on and took no part. All it upheld and nothing had a shape. There was no strong initiator will. An incoherence crossing the firm void slipped into an order of related chance. The pure perception was the only power that stood behind her action and her sight. If that retired, all objects would be extinct. Her private universe would cease to be. The house she had built with bricks of thought and sense in the beginning after the birth of space.
Yes, let's pause there. So at the bottom of page 544, Savitri becomes a silent spirit pervading, like perfume pervades the air, pervading silent space. And then we go back to this idea of the all-negating absolute that Savitri had experienced in another way earlier. But in that absolute stillness, bare and formidable, there was glimpsed an all-negating void, emptiness, a supreme emptiness that claimed its mystic nihil, its nothingness's sovereign right to cancel nature and deny the soul. I think that's the right place to stop for today. Thanks to Sherbindorf.